it's I'm here today because Tony Z was telling me that how does that work? I gotta turn this off. Of course, great things. Pointing me to an interesting talk on high energy effects of string theory at high energy colliders for us, which is of course low energy compared to where string theory supposedly gets interesting. What I would point out, which is what we know, there are other frontiers than the high energy frontier in particle physics. In particular, the current example is neutrino oscillations don't result for the apparent observations of neutrino oscillations. I guess atmospheric neutrino oscillations in particular right now aren't really from the high energy frontier, so to speak. Mainly are at the frontier of experimentalist fortitude and sticking with experiments for an awfully long time. The other thing, one of the reasons we keep digging into our data, for example, at CLIO, is also we're very aware that there are a lot of times historically when effects are in data and just weren't looked for. There's a long catalog of these things, the most recent one being CHARM, which was not discovered. The CHARM quark was not discovered at the high energy frontier at the time and was in the data at the high energy frontier and just not dug out. And it goes back in time like that. Parity violation was first seen in the 30s. Positron was in data in the 20s and not discovered. It goes on and on. So there's a reasonable chance that in the relatively low energy data that we have now, which is now high statistics, that there are interesting effects. And the only real problem, in my opinion, what I'm going to talk about is D0, D0 bar mixing, which is one of the prominent processes that we think new physics may pop out in. And it's probably just too conventional. It's probably too conventional a thing. Whatever is in our data that we're missing is probably more unconventional than this one. So there's a picture of CLIO. For scale, that's about my height across there. And this is the drift chamber. And the colliding beams, it's an experiment, an E plus E minus collider, go in and out of that hole. The beam pipe is absent in this photograph. What's that? It's been upgraded. This is actually CLIO 2 before CLIO 2.5 was put together. It's upgraded all the time is the message. And as a detector goes, it looks kind of old. The reason is, here it is. There's the colliding beams, the center, a bunch of tracking chambers, some crystals that measure photons, a bunch of detectors that measure muons, interleaved with iron to absorb other stuff. There's a distance scale I should have pointed out. The reason it looks old is because it's tall and skinny. These days, you know, we triple the amount of money we spend and get another 30% in acceptance or so. Okay, that's what's happened in modern detectors. Okay, but at the time in the late 70s when this was designed and built, they were saving money, and that's why it looks so tall and narrow. You get most of the solid angle perpendicular to the beam pipe. The purple rust, yeah. It's iron, actually. It's iron. So it's probably rusted now. Yeah. There's a lot of water in this. Actually, one of the biggest concerns is the cooling water not leak on the cesium iodide crystals, which there's $17 million worth of cesium iodide. And if you spilled water on it, it would dissolve into salty water. There have been various upgrades. The one we really participated heavily here from Santa Barbara in was in building a silicon vertex detector that went down in this region. Started really functioning in 1996. The other part we contributed a lot to in various ways was, as I like to say, helium was discovered 100 years ago, right, on the sun. And it took 100 years to get in our drift chambers for some reason. Drift chambers in particle physics should have had helium in them, at least for this application, in the 1970s. But only recently we finally put helium there. Helium reduces the amount of multiple scattering as particle goes through the gas. You get much better resolution if you use it. And it's just inexplicable why it wasn't used. I don't have an explanation. Argon. Argon's cheap is one thing. Because there's argon you just get in the atmosphere. Helium's a little harder to get. But in America, helium's cheap because of all our oil wells. In Europe, helium's kind of more expensive. It's just collective amnesia or something kept it out of our drift chambers. Okay. So in some sort of overview, experimentally, what are we after? You know, there's the table of fermions in the standard model. What we study in Clio are tau leptons, B quarks, and C quarks. We roughly now in our total data sample, 30 million or so of each type. You know, sometimes more, sometimes less, depending on which one, but that's a round number. And pretty much D0, D0 bar mixing, the other things I might address today are what we would call rare decays. And it's reasonable to say, look, you know, if you look at any of these fermions, how well has anyone done at sensitivity to rare processes? Okay? And are we getting there in our studies of heavy quarks? Okay, are we there yet? Should we stop? All right. Studies of the muon looking for lepton flavor violation are at about 10 to the minus 11 sensitivity, a little less. Okay. Kaons, the most recent experiments of Brookhaven, that's the strange quark, have reached about an order of magnitude better. And there's kind of a fundamental limit that gets hit here. If you run an experiment at a megahertz for a year, you get to about 10 to the minus 13th or so. And then you don't always get the whole sensitivity. So that's about where they are right now. Going further is hard, actually. Okay, but these are the smallest or the best sensitivities that I'm aware of. We're not really near that with heavy quarks yet. There's actually a penalty to be paid if you're looking for very rare processes like that one for going to heavy quarks, for example. Okay. They're heavier and they don't live as long. And so if there's some amplitude that's contributing to rare processes, you don't have as long a time to observe it. And crudely, it depends on what mode you're looking at, etc. If you use charm, you're screwed by a factor of 10,000. If you use B quarks, you're screwed by a factor of 100. That's if the coupling of the new physics doesn't care what fermion, what quark it's coupling to. Okay. One thing, then, that we tend to look for are new physics that breaks the universality of coupling to the flavors. And D0, D0 bar mixing is an example of that. Now, there's actually something I should, you know, amend this statement with, and that is, this is true unless you ran into standard model physics when you were looking at the strange quark or the mu. Okay? And in fact, in the K0 system, you run into K0, K0 bar mixing. And you can ask, okay, all right, you've seen K0, K0 bar mixing in the kaon system, or in the strange quark system. How far do you have to go to charm to start to become competitive on sensitivity to new physics? And that's where we've gotten to just recently, or we're almost there with the D0, D0 bar mixing right now. So our limits from D0, D0 bar mixing are about comparable to the best limits. Or will soon be about comparable to the best limits of from kaon physics, which are among the tightest constraints there are on certain supersymmetric theories. Okay.
What are the prospects for pushing the limit of mu and k?
Generally, you're running into this megahertz for a year problem. Okay, that you know, you run an experiment at megahertz and you go for a year, and there's ideas to take this down another three orders of magnitude or so. Okay, that's a gigahertz per year. And how do you do that? Well, a combination of just better computing and faster processing with a little bit of experimental ingenuity to throw away the stuff that gets in your way. Generally, I think a few people I know are throwing away mu D gamma. They think it's too hard now. And people are instead converting to looking for muons to convert on titanium and give electrons, so mu to E conversion. And I don't remember the experimental reason why that's thought to be favorable. Okay. This one, I don't know of anyone who's trying to go further on this one. The problem is with kaon physics is the kaon has lots of ways of decaying and they get in your way. You just can't get rid of them. So we may be stuck on lepton flavor violation there. Okay. So crudely, we've got a long way to go, particularly if you take into account these factors. But there's an experimental point about heavy quarks, and that is the following. We tend to look for new physics, at least first, in two-body decay modes. In fact, if you look at the particle data book, for heavy quarks, with the exception of semi-leptonic modes, most everything we do is two-body. There's very little three-body work in hadronic decays. Okay? And it's experimentally harder. So the two body modes are a reasonable benchmark for how we look for new physics. In the kaon system, the easy one, which is the charge, is 2/3 of the branching ratio. So it's most of what's there. It's a 25th of the branching ratio in the D system. And so you just have to pay, you just have to get more flux to make that up. In the B system, it's a factor of 300 smaller. And it makes it even more challenging than what's done before. I guess in the end, I'm perhaps explaining or maybe apologizing for why heavy quark physics goes on. It's hard. Okay, it's hard to beat these factors. For example, if you make a typical mass plot when you reconstruct something in kaon physics, if you build a reasonable detector, make the mass of the K plus K minus, it comes out as a peak with almost no background typically. It's just not true in heavy quark physics. Because the two body modes are a small fraction of everything, everything else gives you a very high background. And so the way we proceed, or we've been proceeding, is we just build better and better detectors to try to get our mass resolutions better and better and keep the backgrounds from getting in our way. Part of the story today is we upgraded, that's why we're continually upgrading the Clio detector. And the increased experimental sensitivity to demixing we're getting has resulted exactly from this sort of thing. Okay. The last thing that makes it hard for heavy quark physics is they don't go very far. The flight distance of muons and kaons is kilometers. And it means experiments that you work on. I worked on NA31, a kaon experiment at CERN. There's some people in this picture. This is the apparatus in the north area at CERN. So it gives you a feeling for the scale of these experiments when you use kaons. So this was 10 years ago I worked on the NA31 experiment. And here's a detector down here with another person. We built a transition radiation detector for that experiment. And that gives you a feeling for the size of a typical detector. Meters is a good approximation of how big they are. These days, because heavy quarks don't fly very far, instead of going kilometers, they go hundreds of microns. Okay? And so the detectors end up looking like this. This is a tabletop at Cornell after we shipped the new detector back there. Okay? And, okay, so this is half the detector that surrounds the beam pipe. The colliding beams go in and out. The one thing about this detector is, as small as it is, it has 30 times as many channels as the one I just showed you. Okay. The ratio of cost is this about double. Okay. And yeah, then the big one. Oh, why is it so much more expensive? These things, these things are silicon detectors in here, and each one of them is $10,000 or so. I always used to think a new car when I'd have one in my hand. You know, that's the sort of scale of these things. And then well, there are 64 of those, and that starts to get, that's the main cost, okay. Cheaper, partly because, you know, if you ever built fire chambers, it's sort of like building them in your garage, you know. All the labor was postdocs at CERN and technicians and so forth. We didn't buy anything from Japan that cost $500,000. We just built it, okay? And most of the cost here was the heavy engineering of, these are stesolite frames and various things. Xenon gas, although we got it cheap from the Soviet Union. Okay. Okay. That was an experience. Okay. Okay. But this miniaturization maybe wasn't even expected. And it's taken a while to develop. Oh, let me comment. I thought since this thing came from a talk or from a discussion with Tony, I'd put up a paper he wrote actually 24 years ago. I'll call this the second paragraph. This is the first paragraph, okay? This is the one I'd like to read. This is the first real sensible information I've ever found in the literature on demixing, okay? But the second paragraph is, since charmed mesons will pretty surely have lifetimes too small to permit direct measurements of the kind that have been carried out on the K-short, K-long system, One can at best hope to get information on mixing only through indirect methods by integrating count rates over time. Okay? Turned out to just not be so. That detector I just showed you is what makes it possible to look for mixing by looking for the time dependence of something. Okay? And, of course, 1975, the first silicon detectors weren't even really made. Okay? And so that's what's happened. I guess as far as generalities of detectors and so forth, the last thing here is there's kind of a competition going on between doing heavy quark physics at machines that use protons and antiprotons. There's a list of some of them. And those that use E plus E minus colliders. And more or less, the story is you get a higher rate of heavy quarks at these colliders. But the problem is you can't find them. You can't dig them out of everything else. And you've got to build some sort of trigger based on the flight distance, which is very hard since it's only hundreds of microns. And that isn't really ready yet. So if that were ready, the physics would be coming out of these sort of experiments. Since it's not, E plus E minus colliders, which have a much more modest rate but are much cleaner by nature so you don't need to trigger, are now outperforming whatever one might get from the hadronic colliders. It may not be that way forever, by the way. One thing about the E plus E minus environments, really only had these silicon detectors. The first one at one of these colliders was installed in 1996, and that was the one we built here. Okay, and that's where these results are coming from. That's the last comment. Talk about some physics, or more phenomenology type physics. So there's the table of heavy fermions. And you can build up neutral mesons by picking a quark. S and D bar gives you a K0 bar, etc. If you build out of this column of quarks, you get these three systems. And if the distinctive thing about D0, D0 bar mixing is it's the only real viable system where we can look for particle-antiparticle mixing using quarks from that column, because the top quark is so short-lived it's never going to mix, basically. So if there's some distinction with flavor involving some weak, very weak, super weak type interaction, maybe D0, D0 bar mixing is the place to look for it. So let me leave that there. A short few comments about mixing phenomena and phenomenology, very experimentally inclined. Of course, this phenomenon was discovered in the Kaon system in the 50s and first suggested theoretically and ultimately found experimentally. But there's a slight distinction I'd like to bring up because it's kind of important experimentally. If a K0 decays to, for example, pi plus pi minus, which is now a CP eigenstate, it's neutral, it doesn't know what flavor it had, so it can recombine and form a K0 bar. If all of that is at the mass of the K0 on shell, okay, the kind of mixing you get is characterized by this cartoon. So there's time along the horizontal axis, and the log of the number of kaons you have is a function of time. And crudely, the K0 and K0 bar, in absence of this phenomenon, would both have exponential and equal lifetimes. Okay. And then let's just call that lifetime one. And I'll always use that. There's no point in carrying around that lifetime. Okay. The physics of this particular mixing is that it causes the system to split into one state where that diagram interferes destructively, and so the admixture tends not to decay at all. It has a very, very long lifetime, the K-long. And crudely, it's infinite on this time scale. Now, it's not exactly infinite, but crudely, it's infinite. Okay. And in some useful units, if it were infinite, this type of mixing would be characterized by the normalized amplitudes, or normalized amplitude y, and that would be plus one in the convention. Not quite one, because the lifetime isn't quite infinity. Okay. Similarly, the other mixture, where the decays add constructively, goes down and has half the lifetime of the pre-existing state. Now, this was the first mixing that was really strongly suggested by Gell-Mann and Pais. It was the first one seen experimentally. The odd thing is, it's not that interesting. It involves physics of the decay. It's not that interesting, it just exists. Okay. And the more interesting one is if particle and antiparticle mix through off-shell virtual intermediate states, where the interesting contribution in the kaon system came from the charm quark. And what this does, if you start with a K0, it gradually oscillates away, and a K0 bar gradually builds up. And so you see flavor oscillations through virtual intermediate states. This is usually characterized by a different normalized amplitude in units of the lifetime, delta M. It shifts the relative masses of these two admixtures as well. In the kaon system, it's very nearly minus 1. It's minus 0.8 or so, okay? Which means, in some sense, the kaon system is critically damped. Experimentally, the thing about this was first seen in 1960, and it's an experiment people don't know that much about, I guess. Maybe some people in this room do, I don't know. But it's not that, the distinction between these two mixings are not always taken care of very carefully experimentally. But it was 1960, 14 years before that experiment was used to estimate the mass of the charm quark. In 1973 or so. Okay. And if there was sort of a picture of what we're trying to do with demixing, this is it. Fine mixing that indicates new physics on a mass scale that we won't get to for another 20 or 30 years. It goes even farther in the kaon system. There's another virtual contribution through the top quark, where what actually happens is that's the CP violating contribution, where the coupling is actually complex and adds a small imaginary part to the virtual intermediate states. And the interesting thing is, if you start from a K0 and go to a K0 bar, that imaginary part interferes constructively with the previous old uninteresting amplitude. If this guy wasn't there, you wouldn't experimentally be able to see this one. Okay, but it is, so you can. If you start from a K0 bar and go the other way, the sign flips on the imaginary part of the virtual contribution, and you see interference the other direction. Yeah. 1960, that's right. There was a crude thing. Actually, Gell-Mann and Pais's paper noted that there could be this kind of contribution as well. Okay. They really spent most of their time on the on-shell type of mixing. Then, between 1955 and 1960, there were suggestions by Serber and various other people who were familiar with this kind of phenomena from nuclear physics, that there could be this other contribution. It should be about this magnitude. Just phenomenologically, just saying, we don't understand it. It could be there. Why don't you guys go look for it? And Piccioni is the guy, the experimentalist, who pushed on this without really good motivation. It's kind of a credit to him, in my opinion. Yeah. No, it was there. I mean, yeah. But they didn't know what it was from, though. They didn't really, and, one odd thing is the sign of it tends to support, a high-mass object. There could be contributions from either side, and, from low-mass virtual states or high-mass. The sign of it tends to support that it was a high-mass object in the end. And that, but certainly they weren't saying the charm quark in 1960. That was not the explanation. Just order of magnitude, that this would be of order of magnitude 1, I think, was kind of understood. And then, experimentally, CP violation was discovered in 1964, and in some sense, it's the same story over again. The top quark was detected 23 years or something before it was discovered, okay? Maybe, if you look at it that way. Okay. Okay, so then, to mention talk about the experimental issues, then, the thing about these quarks, I gotta take that away, is they live a long time. Their decays are Kibibo suppressed, and these quarks' decays are Kibibo favored. So the time you have to get them to mix is much shorter. It means that from pure coupling of the Kibibo angle, if you like, considerations, you'd expect the mixing to be about 5% in the charm system. Just because it decays so fast, doesn't have a chance to mix. But it goes beyond that, okay? If SU3 symmetry, that these three quarks are just identical copies in some sense of each other, works, there's a further suppression, noted in Tony's paper actually, that would take you down even smaller. Okay? And the fact that this suppression is often used amongst experimentalists to say, why bother to look for that? Experimentally, it's very hard to imagine ever getting sensitivity to that. Okay? And the counter-argument is, so what about SU3 anyway? For example, in D decays, SU3 says the single Kubiba-suppressed decays, K plus, K minus, should be equal in branching ratio to the single to pi plus, pi minus. And experimentally, it's not even close. They're off by a factor of almost 3. So SU3 ain't any good is the usual, is the reply to that. And go ahead and search for this. Such a large SU3 breaking that's manifest already might lead you to say, well, gosh, okay, could there be new physics in this? If you see mixing, is it just old physics? Okay. And the signature of new physics would be that the virtual amplitudes would be much greater than the real ones, than the on-shell ones. Okay. And in a sense, then if you really want to know you've got new physics, you've got to measure both. In a sense, you've got to cross-check. If you measure both and you see X is big and Y is small, you'll start to say this is new physics and not standard model physics necessarily. Not all experiments are able to distinguish these two. That's an important experimental detail. Ours is, actually. Okay. Then once you're looking for new physics, about what size could it start coming in on? Well, the limits from the D system, when you get to about 1%, start to become as tight as those you can deduce from the Kaon system. Many non-standard models would give charm mixing. Okay, the canonical diagram in I guess, softly broken supersymmetry is something like this. Squarks, a loop that can take a charm squark, for example, to an up squark, involving a Higgs zeno and a normal quark. The other thing that would show you new physics would be if there was large CP violation in what you saw. Okay. That would probably be a signature of new physics. So from my perspective, all I did this summer was go and get every prediction I could find in the literature. And there's 65 predictions. Okay. And here's mixing amplitude, those things X and Y. Bigger than 1 is very unlikely. And what you can see here are 3 different types of points. Standard model calculations, where they tend to be low in the range of 10 to the minus 4, okay, or so. A few people argue SU3 symmetry breaking should keep them high and be up in near 0.05. Standard Y, very few predictions, actually. There aren't enough measurements to really do well there. And then non-standard model predictions. And crudely, you can see the red dots are systematically higher on average. Okay, not all of them, but they're systematically higher.
It's just, why is it for the standard model that your predictions vary so much?
There are a couple
reasons. It's not due to confidence. I mean, in a standard model, well, in a standard model, people should get the same answer, no?
No.
Because different types of things.
I can say no one has calculated that. You know, the SU3 breaking, for example. That's not understood in lattice gauge theory. Maybe it's just it's not considered an interesting problem and no one's worked on it.
Yep.
Absolutely right. Yeah. These aren't error bars. These are ranges. Sometimes predictions come with a range. Well, the horizontal is just reference index. There's 65 of them, and I just it's roughly chronological. Okay. And. I should say crudely. Yeah, I could say crudely. This is somewhere in here. It was an HQET started to get calculated. It is crudely chronological, not exactly, but crudely chronological. These references are on a web page. that's hyperlinked into Spires. You can get each one of these papers in 30 seconds, okay, if you want. All right, go to my webpage and you can ultimately find it. Okay, it's also in a preprint that gives a big table of these. Okay, it's a contribution. I didn't make it into a real paper. It's a contribution to the Lepton Photon this summer. But I just wanted to tabulate these things. There's another thing. The D mesons are near the resonant region of K's and pi's. So the mass scale from 2 to 1 GeV is full of weird resonances that are not well experimentally measured, and lattice gauge theory isn't anywhere near, I don't think, calculating that region. Okay, so that's
no, but as Mark said, lattice gauge theory is so
it's
let's say that you are taking some particular moles, right? Which are memories of those moles are unknown from.
No, experiment hasn't measured a lot of the modes.
You measured some of them.
Some of them, actually. That's right.
Okay, so I wonder if these calculations are based on some of the experimental input for 16 moles.
There are people who take pure phenomenological sort of estimates. Okay, and that's like this point is a recent Italian, Colangelo et al. Okay, for example, and they tend the people who try to do phenomenology of the branching ratios tend to end up systematically higher than the people who take HQET, for example. George, I did all this stuff with HQET; it was systematically lower. Okay, so that's where we're hunting, but still, the comparison of X and Y can still tell you whether you're standard or non-standard. Even at the level, many people hope the level of X would enable you to distinguish standard from non-standard. If that, and that may be controversial, but comparison of the two amplitudes, X and Y, is a lot less controversial as a way to determine whether you have new physics. Okay, so experimentally, what do? We start with a beautiful resonance that exists in the D system, the D star, which is just the spins of the two quarks, now that should be U bar, okay, sorry, are up, spin flips and emits a pion into K, and you're extremely near threshold. This pion just gets a little bit of energy in this decay. So experimentally, it's beautiful. It's very distinct, and that's why we use it. It does something else. That's not the only reason we use it, though. The charge of this pion tells you what charm you started from. If you have a pi plus, you have a D0. If you have a pi minus, it's a D0 bar. Okay. And then what you do is what we're looking for as a signature of mixing is the final state K plus pi minus. As comment, the normal decay of the D0 would be to K minus pi plus. So look for the so-called wrong sign final state. And you can get there through two paths, mixing to a D0 bar and then favored decay to K plus pi minus. That would be mixing, but also there's another way. Okay, there can be direct decay, so-called doubly Kibibo suppressed decay, that takes you directly to that state without mixing. The main distinction between them is it takes some time, there's one power of the time from the Hamiltonian, to build up the D0 bar. And that's the key, okay, at distinguishing mixing from there's no powers of time. You see exponential decay if you have a double Kibibo suppressed decay.
By the end, both effects are compatible or not? I mean,
Good question. Okay, crudely, if there's no SU3 suppression, if there were no SU3 suppression, they'd be almost identical. They'd be typically about the same in amplitude. To the extent SU3 suppresses this route, it would be much smaller than that route.
Okay. So then you would not see this, right?
Well, the way you see it is
on the level of suppression.
If you measure the time dependence, okay, and just work out the then crudely the number of wrong sign decays as a function of time will have a pure exponential piece, which will be the left hand route, an interference piece, which involves it would involve Y, but there's another complication. In a strong decay you can have a strong phase contribute. That is, these guys can come out in two different Bessel functions, if you like. Okay, so there can be a complex number that multiplies.
You mean final state scattering.
Final state scattering. That's right, if you like. Okay, and so there's a slight complication. You're not really sensitive to the real intermediate state mixing as the coefficient of the time dependence, but a slightly rotated of it. There's an interference term that gives you linear dependence in time. And finally, this process, were it there alone, would give you a time squared dependence, the amplitude squared. So there's three terms that we try to sense. Okay. And that's what the experiment is about. It becomes harder and harder to detect if this is very small compared to that.
That's right.
It's small, but it lives a long time. So experimentally, it's interesting from that perspective.
What is this long? Yeah. In fact, I'm bothered by this. I remember, but the formula, which you say is the build up of the digital.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely right. Okay. It's absolutely right.
Is that experimentally adequate?
Yes. It is. Yes. It is right. But ultimately, what matters is these branching ratios are very small compared to the total, the right side branching ratio. And yeah, all you do is replace this with a sine of t and not with a cosine of t to get it right. Okay. It's not that hard. Well, experimentally, what's great about this process is that. The right sine decay, that one, so wrong sine is that, right sine, goes like gangbusters. So you have this signal that looks almost identical, except for some flips of signs, to your rare process. You have a strong process that's very easy to find that you can use to essentially calibrate your detector and look for the weak process. And so let's look at the strong process for a second. Since there's two, it's a sequence of two decays, there are essentially two masses we can two things we reconstruct usually. The energy released in this decay, that's the top plot here. So there's energy release, number of events per some bin size. And it's small, it's of order 5 MeV compared to the masses of these particles are 2 JeV and 140 MeV or so. So it's real small. And this is our signal, this is our data. Okay? So there's a very nice peak. And very narrow, some tenth of an MeV. Experimentally, the upgrades that I didn't describe in detail but that we worked on reduce the resolution by somewhere between a factor of 3 and 4. So this peak is now narrower than it was before the UCSB contributions, okay, by a factor of 3 or 4. Similarly, if I make the mass of the candidates for those particles, that's plotted along the bottom axis, there's the mass. See, the mass of the D0 is about 1.86 GeV. That also got narrower by a factor of 2 due to, for example, putting helium in the drift chamber. Helium was the main one here. Okay. Why do those matter? When we just flip the sign, that to a K plus and that to a pi minus, but hold the pi plus there, what you're going to see is this little rubble that's background will become much more prominent. We're looking for a tiny little peak. Okay, compared to these guys. So let's just look at that. So there's now the wrong sign version of this process. Okay. And what you can see is somehow now the background is much more prominent. So much more rare process. And here's, the energy release and the mass. And it's worse than that. The background, you can see this cyan contribution to background without telling you exactly what that is. These are different contributions to the background. There's a component of background that knows how to make a peak right in the vicinity of where the signal is. Okay. But we knew it was a much broader peak. If we could get our experimental resolution sufficiently narrow, we could clearly see this. So there it is. There's the peak in one projection and another projection. You can see in the mass projection, one of the backgrounds also knows exactly how to peak. Okay, it turns out. And these are the sorts of complications we had to deal with that did. At the end of the day, this is the most clear and convincing version of the signal ever seen. It's not even close, actually. Okay, and it's coming in at about a third of a percent relative to the right sine. Okay. And the question is, what are these events? Are they coming from the left-hand path or the right-hand path in the earlier diagram? Are they mixing or are they just direct decay? So to get that, we have to take these events and plot their how long they go before they decay. So we take the events in a window around those masses and do something to them.
Don't you have to worry about whether your initial e-stop parts is contaminated by e-stop mining?
You do. Generally, that doesn't happen very often. Okay. Actually, all these multicolored curves here are the results of detailed simulations of all this stuff.
But yet, not yeah. the same kind of level. That's not
there it is.
But, yeah. The graph shows the second.
That's right.
Right. And in this way, if you go contamination, the text will come.
Okay. Yeah. Actually, what these come from are cases where it was a D star minus, you got a D zero pi minus, and then you missed the pi minus. And you swap in a fake pi plus, and then you could see the characteristics they have. Well, then it becomes a D zero bar that decays to K plus pi minus. You've tagged wrong. You got a real D bar, so they peak in this projection. But you had a phony slow pi on, so there's no peak there. There's a lot of tricks like that. I don't know. Of order 10 little studies and tricks to suppress stuff like that I'm glossing over. Okay, how do we reconstruct the time? There's a couple interesting things here. Probably, in many ways, the most interesting thing is just this purple blob is what the beam at a typical E plus E minus collider looks like. If the electrons are going into the screen and the positrons are coming out, you can ask, what's the size of the region where they intersect and collide? Okay. And if the ring is going around us in the horizontal, what you'll see is the region of annihilation is much bigger in the horizontal than it is in the vertical. Okay. And the reason is synchrotron radiation. Okay. Makes the particles have a lot of dispersion in configuration space in the horizontal. Typically at Caesar, it's about 700 microns full width at half mass. But in the vertical, the ring is in the horizontal plane. So what's happening in the vertical are just alignment problems and ability to make magnets and stuff like that. So it's really tiny in the vertical. So the way we actually do the physics here of the lifetime is the annihilation occurs there. You make a D star plus. Okay. The details of that aren't important. Okay. The D star plus decays strongly, so it immediately decays while it's still in the beam cloud and gives you the tag pion, which is slow, and then the D zero, which flies for a while. And the part of the flight path that really gives you experimental information is the vertical component, since you know very well where everything started from in the vertical. So we just throw away the horizontal component, and there's also a component in and out of the screen. Forget about it. Okay. And from that one component, we reconstruct everything. Well, not quite everything. We need to know the momentum of it. Okay, and we measure that in our spectrometer. And reconstruct the proper time in the rest frame of the decay based upon that difference and momentum and the mass, et cetera. And we normalize to the average lifetime of the D0. Mixing is a small effect, so there's no effect on the average lifetime.
And what is the characteristic size?
Characteristic, it was 10, 20 microns. This one characteristically is 150 microns of that order. And that's what the silicon vertex detector did for us. It was able to do that. So you can ask, because we have this nice calibration signal of the right sign process, first look at our ability to reconstruct the flight path from that. And so you take those decays and you can see, there you go, normalized to D0 lifetimes, the number of events. So this is the same plot, linear and logarithmic. Okay. What you see here is the result of an exponential decay folded with a resolution function that smeared it out. Okay. But it's, you know, zero is this dark line and it's clearly shifted to the right. And actually, our data are the most precise in the world for measuring the D lifetime. We're good to about 1% now. And actually, to publish something on this takes a lot of work to do systematic errors. We're good to about the 1% level. For now going and taking the relatively small number of decays that are here, percent type errors just don't matter. We're dominated by statistical errors. And then the question is, what is it going to look like if we take these decays? Here's folded with our resolution a bunch of different options. Something that has no lifetime. Well, if light quarks are made and they're background to us, you just see something peaked at zero or centered on zero. That's what an exponential looks like folded with our resolution function. The consequences of mixing are showed here. T times an exponential, t squared times an exponential. And the separation is easily adequate to determine what's going on. Well, there's a lot of details at that point. I haven't yet optimized this for showmanship. I'm just going to show you the data and our best fit to it.
What is the total number you
have? I should tell you that, yes. Okay, 45. 45 signal events in that earlier peak. And the background, it's about two-thirds signal, a little less than two-thirds signal, about one-third background. Okay. And actually, that fraction of signal was thought impossible. Okay, that, you know, back when we were proposing this stuff, we didn't think we'd get two-thirds signal. We thought we'd get a quarter signal or something. So it turned out better than we thought. So, yeah. 45. You can see that's reasonable. There's about 25 in that peak. Oh, the data is the, I should have said more clearly, the data is the dots with error bars, and these multicolored things are fits to the data, actually. So we actually estimate the number of events by counting up the blue area. Okay. And these other things are other contributions. I wasn't very clear about that. But it's maybe more important now that we plot up the lifetime of these guys. Here's what we get. So what's being plotted here as a function of D0 lifetimes are just those events, those 45 or so events. The data are the dark circles with error bars. Okay. And this yellow contribution is light quark background, which has zero lifetime. And then there, a lot of our background consists of charm that is not our signal process. It's actually charm that's background. And that's the cyan contribution. The final increment, blue here, is what our fit tells us is the contribution due to direct decay, no mixing. Okay. And the truth is our best fit likes a reasonable amount, not a significant amount, of interference, but destructive interference, actually. Okay, between the direct decay process and mixing. Now, one thing that's very, very clear is the fit does not like the source of these wrong sign events to be pure mixing. If that were true, the blue region would look something like that. This whole blue region would want to be look like the purple region. So it's very, very clear we're not seeing pure mixing as the source of these events. Okay. But, yeah. Yes, the interference is not the dominant tendency. Okay, in more detail, so the more detailed numbers, if we fit that data, there's really no tendency towards a non-zero x prime. That's the new physics amplitude. Okay, there is a tendency; it's not significant, towards a mixing amplitude through real intermediate states, and a destructive and that destructively interferes and makes the lifetime shorter. It's a little less than a 2 sigma effect. During the summer, this was quite a bit bigger than 2 sigma with half our data. When we analyzed the first half of our data sample and got everything set, we thought we had a signal. We added the second half, it went down to 1.8 sigma. So we don't think it's significant. And then if you'd like a table of numbers, our actual best fit numbers are given here. This is the mixing, or this is the direct decay fits at 0.5% with an error of about 0.1%. That's bigger than explains the total area because there's destructive interference of about -2.5%, plus or minus 1.5%, coming from real intermediate states. No evidence at all for virtual intermediate states. Okay, that's our best fit. And given that there's no evidence for something being non-zero, it's close here, but it's not. Okay. We then have made various limit plots in the two-dimensional plane of x prime versus y prime, and that's this plot. Okay. So what's plotted here is what's approximately the amplitude for real intermediate states versus the amplitude for virtual intermediate states. And B before our experiment, the allowed regions came from two fixed target experiments at Fermilab of different types, one using CP eigenstates, which limits the real intermediate states, and one that uses semi-leptonic decays that limits the sum of the squares of both, and so it's a circle. And what's being plotted here is amplitude also, by the way. It's the, you square it to get rates. Our limits are in cyan, if there's no CP violation allowed in any of the fits, our allowed region is this offset circle. It's offset from the origin. It tends to favor slightly negative wise, but it's consistent with zero, actually. Okay. Once we allow CP violation to be present, okay, the limits get a little looser, but not really significantly. Okay. There's a secondary minimum if you allow CP violation that takes the limit curve out up there. And this point that our limits don't get much worse if you allow CP violation turns out to be a big point experimentally. The previous, this experiment had a different configuration and had trouble limiting things if there was CP violation present. CP violation is a significant thing to allow. Okay. So, yeah. Yes. Yeah, good question. What if the phase were non-zero, would take this plot and imagine the colored region staying in the same place. You'd take the plot out, you'd take it, rotate it through zero, and you just rotate the axes of the plot. Okay. So what's labeled here as y prime could actually be, well, it's not necessarily the same as y. Mm-hmm. Okay. And if you wanted to change, if you wanted to relabel this plot with x and y, you'd have to know the strong phase.
Yeah.
If it's zero, then it's x and y are what's plotted here, if the strong phase is zero.
But then I would think that it would be only y, not x, contributing, right? If, because interference would be not there, is x, or maybe I'm wrong.
Yes, interference is not there with x.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
So then it would be probably strong. If your limit is statistic, it would be more stronger limitation for the position of y if you will, presume that phase is zero.
Right. If you presume the phase is zero, we get the strongest, we get a weaker limit on y because if there's destructive interference. Yeah. Okay, that's the way it looks. This can go negative and gives you a weaker limit in the end. Okay. Well, after all this, you know, the target, our target was to beat 0.05 in every scale here. We did. Okay, that's double Kibibo suppression. We beat that. Okay, so we're beginning to probe. Once you get under 0.05, you're probing the SU3, the posited SU3 cancellation. Okay.
Yeah. Again,
yes. Let me. There's a summary. Okay. That X prime is virtual, presumably new physics. The way we think about it experimentally is what's the rate of new physics, what's the branching ratio, or how many D0s go to D0 bars through virtual intermediate states. There's an asterisk here, like Roger Maris's home run. Okay, you have to assume the strong phase is negligible. And this is getting questioned, that the strong phase is negligible. Okay, you know, right now it's being questioned. Okay, but if you assume that, then we're saying at the rate of new physics D0, D0 bar mixing is less than 0.04%. Okay. And this had been over an order of magnitude larger, okay, in the last version of the particle data book from an experiments that were dominated by a fixed target experiment. Well, okay. If you go back and look at all those predictions, we exclude about 18 of them. Okay. So this is an expanded region of the mixing amplitude X. And it's not easy to see. The magenta points are various models. And our limits, we allow all those that are in the red or below. And there are about 18 that are above. The reason there are so many limits above is, in my opinion, not a great physical principle. It's what we've been calling the Canadian border effect. That in Canada, the population density is highest along the southern border. New models tend to rot. Demixing is desired by a lot of models. And people fiddle with their models until they get just below the experimental limit. So it's a Canadian border effect. That's right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, they have a lot of... okay. But really the message is there are a lot of models that are sensitive to that demixing is sensitive to. Okay. Our conclusions and prospects, okay, so we've overtaken fixed target experiments in our sensitivity. Okay. If we keep going, I think there's another order of magnitude and rate available. Okay.
So you said 18 models, these models is not
new physics? New physics. Yes.
Those which are on the higher side.
That's right. Yeah. Some standard models. Hall and Weinberg?
No.
You want me to name it? Higgs doublets, various supersymmetry. Yossi Nier has this thing where he aligns the down-type quarks, and the up-type quarks get out of control, and there's mixing there. He was more or less inconsistent. Okay. My webpage, you can go through and okay. There's a new fixed target experiment that they think they'll get to similar sensitivity. If you keep going and doing this physics with Babar, I think there's yet another two orders of magnitude one could get to, so about 10 to the minus 7. Okay. And that's roughly, it's not quite the, you could ask the question, Babar is going to have about 10 to the ninth decays to start from. And why can't they get to mixings that are, or mixing rates that are 10 to the, 1 in 10 to the ninth or so? Ultimately, this necessity to tag the charm of the meson is what costs you, it turns out. Okay?
So you mean that if you take a symmetric mean, it would be not
intuitive? No, this is just, none of us get all the sensitivity that our number of charm particles would indicate. We all always end up about 100 times less sensitive than one would guess just from the number of charm particles we have. And the reason is we have to tag the flavor of the charm before it decays. That's all the only point I was making here. Babar does have a different experimental configuration, and we don't know yet whether it hinders them or not. I don't think it does, but it could. Okay, we don't really know. Actually, the bigger experimental question is whether the Fermilab and CERN experiments that use hadrons will nail us all again, whether the sensitivity will shift back to those machines. Okay. Maybe there's a real intermediate state signal emerging. Don't know. The rest is my own speculation. Having worked on epsilon prime over epsilon, I often feel that what's happened is the confirmation of the CERN result has made it more likely that the explorations of CP violation in the B system will be a verification rather than a discovery. Now, that's just more likely. In absolute terms, this study of CP violation in the B system is one of the best places to look for new physics, too. But somehow, my own mind, and you know, we didn't start looking for demixing. We started looking for demixing long before the new results on epsilon prime over epsilon came out. Okay, but the chances that there's going to be a verification may mean that charm mixing is one of the last best hopes for new physics. Thanks.
Any other questions?
My pleasure. Thanks. Thanks. That's what we tried. Thanks. Well, you know, I don't know. Cleo may be dead. It may not be. I'm not sure. I don't think so.